You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at why millennials are having fewer children and many opting to go child-free more than the generations that came before them. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about remembering our loved ones.
When someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness, how do we choose to preserve the memory of that person? Radio producer Alexandra Salmon and her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, have always been close. When Chris was recently diagnosed with terminal cancer, Alexandra started recording some of their conversations. And on a perfect fall day, the two of them talked about Chris's lifelong connection to Wisconsin and what she hopes to leave behind.
I think I'm experiencing some of the sounds in my mind because they're sounds of little kids laughing and having fun. And that's, if I had had a woods like this near me, I would have been in it.
That's my mother-in-law, Chris Thomas. We're in the woods near her house in Madison, where she's thinking about putting her memorial bench. This little piece of wildness reminds her of another park she loved as a child.
It wasn't right at our near our house, but it was down at Westmoreland Park. And once I was old enough to have my freedom to go down there, it was really fun. I mean, we played in a woods like this. It was a little deeper and darker than this one, but kids just fantasize. They love having places like this to come to. And we hear kids down here giggling and, you know, playing, and it's really nice.
Chris is such a practical person, and she's always thought about putting other people first. The way she's approaching this memorial bench is no different. Can you just talk a little bit about this bench idea?
Well, it's certainly a copycatted idea all over the place. I mean, lots of people have benches, and I never thought of myself as somebody that wanted to mark my spot or be so impressive that I had a bench. I don't know why I thought about it, except that I like the fact that there are places for people to sit who, you know, people who might not walk this trail otherwise. If they knew there was a bench every so often, they might walk it more. And I think that's a good goal, to have something out here that people can actually utilize. So it's my little contribution to getting people out walking, you know, especially people that wouldn't do it otherwise.
Oh, what's this? Walnut?
Maybe. Yeah, it's hollow. Maybe from where we're standing, we look at what we're seeing. If I stand at a diagonal, I see that big tree, and that is the only really big tree right in there. And you know what? If we find another spot, fine, you know. But I kind of like this spot. It feels good. Yeah, I think along this trail, and the other trail would get used. But it'd just be sitting out along a trail. And this is so pretty in here.
Yeah.
So special. Yeah.
Well, and really, I do like those hidden benches.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like a surprise. You
mm-hmm.
come upon it, and then you think about who was this person?
Yeah. One winter when I walked in the arboretum a lot, I found a chrysalis or something hanging from a thread, and I watched that thing all winter, and then one day it was gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was audio producer Alexandra Salmon talking with her mother-in-law, Chris Thomas of Madison, about her memorial bench. Big thanks to Meeker and Maiden for letting us use their version of the song, Hills of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, millennials, that's people born between 1981 and 1996, are having children at significantly lower rates than previous generations. According to Pew Research, as of 2018, about 55% of women between the ages of 22 and 37 had given birth. That was down 7% from Generation X, which is already down a little compared to baby boomers. And millennial women are also more likely to continue to remain childless throughout their childbearing years. So far, lots of millennial women are still in those childbearing years. We don't know yet whether they're just delaying having kids or aren't going to have them at all. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you a millennial? Do you plan to have children or have you already had kids? Have you made a decision to delay it, put it off, or maybe not at all? And what is driving those decisions or maybe those debates about whether to have kids? Or if you're watching your kids deciding whether to have kids, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Kuntz is Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's the author of a lot of books on gender, family, and history, including the forthcoming For Better and Worse, The Problematic Past, and Uncertain Future of Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
There are a number of ways to slice this question, but what, when you look at the data, Stephanie, what are you seeing when it comes to how many kids millennials are having, whether they're having at all?
Well, it is, as you say, too early to say, because the reproduction rates of women in their 40s have actually gone up. But of course, there is a biological limit. I think there are a lot of things going on here. First of all, people have to recognize that there's been a huge change over the past 80, 100 years in what kids mean. It used to be that having kids was an economic asset. You lived on a farm, you could do child labor. They've gradually become an economic sacrifice, especially having them early or having more than one or two. And people feel they have to save up for them. Women in particular feel they have to be set both educationally and occupationally. But at the same time, to the extent that they feel they're going to have to continue to work after the baby comes, they're very concerned about whether they're going to be able to balance those. And the old, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, if a society made it hard for women to combine work and family, they started having more babies. But today, it works exactly the opposite. The more a society makes it difficult for women to combine work and family, the more likely they are to reduce their family size or not have kids at all. And there's a really complicated list of reasons that people have for not having babies. But as of 2018, the gap between the number of kids women and men say they want to have and actually have reached had hit its highest level in 40 years. So there's something going on besides the fact, although this is an important fact too, that people do feel more socially acceptable to say, no, I don't want kids at all. A lot of people want them, but just don't think they can afford or risk having them or as many as they want.
Now, a lot of millennials came of age right on top of the Great Recession or soon thereafter, a really bad time to do things like enter the job market. How big a factor has that been, do you think, on millennials and having kids?
I think it's a huge effect. We saw a little rebound after the recession, but then we began to get these problems of college debt, increasingly precarious jobs, so that even people who make a good living while they're employed are more concerned about their future employment prospects. And of course, they're more concerned about their children's prospects, more concerned about having to send their child. And this leads to this intensive competitive parenting, which is stressful for both parents and the children. How can I get them into the best college possible? Because even college educated kids, some of them are falling behind. So there's all those sorts of pressures, that economic pressures that are going on. And then those combined with the fact that America has very, very poor social policies to allow you to combine work and family. So you feel like I'm going to have to keep working after I have the child. And yet it's so difficult to combine work with having a baby or a toddler that it's just a tremendous pull for women and for men.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz with the Council on Contemporary Families about trends in how many kids people are having, down so far or delayed in many cases for millennials, digging into some of the reasons behind that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jason is with us in Chippewa Falls. Jason, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
I was just going to make comments on my wife and I, like one reason we haven't done it. You know, we want to, we well-educated individuals, we think we would be pretty good at raising a kid, but at the same time, we look at our finances, and I was lucky enough to buy a house in my 20s. So I'm like at the beginning of the whole millennial, maybe kind of grouped into millennials, mm-hmm. I think. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get a house in my 20s. And that mortgage is only like $500-$600 a month. But you look at our student loans and it's about $2,500 a month. And it's been that way for like 10 years. And you look at what it takes to get certain jobs. In my wife's case, physical therapist, but now you got to get a doctorate. Her education costs more than my home. And especially now, like we're in our later 30s. And financially, I think we could do it now. But, you know, in the past 2 years with these inflated costs, I'm thinking the idea is going to sunset on us before we get the opportunity.
Jason, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Stephanie, illustrating one of the points you were just making, some people like Jason and his wife, looking at the household balance sheet, the numbers don't add up for them for having a kid.
Oh, that's right. There was a poll taken in 2018 of why people were putting off or not sure or deciding that they didn't want children. And 6 of the top 8 reasons were connected to this kind of economic thing. Worried about the economy, financial instability, needing to get more education or time on the job, but also childcare too expensive, no paid family leave, not enough leave. All of those kinds of things, there's a tremendous amount of concern about that. And it's a quite justifiable concern. You know, as a historian, I have to say, I am not at all nostalgic for the marriages of the 1950s and 60s because, or the gender relations, because they were extremely unfair. I mean, there were even things like marital rape was allowed. But I am nostalgic, and I understand a certain amount of nostalgia for the political and economic trends with the New Deal and Great Society and men's real wages rising all the time. So, you know, people, I think, are really feeling the pressure when it comes to thinking about what you're going to do with your kids in order to raise your own kids, and if, in fact, you have enough going on for you to be able to get your kids off to a good start.
Jason, thanks again for that call. Talking to Stephanie Kuntz with the Council on Contemporary Families, talking about why millennials, in many cases, are choosing not to have children or to delay having children as compared to previous generations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a millennial, want to hear your thoughts on having kids, whether you're having them or not, if you're the parent of millennials or younger people, what are you seeing them talking about when it comes to whether or not you end up with grandkids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, looking at why millennials are having kids at lower rates than the generations before them, at least so far. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Millennials, want to hear about your thoughts on having children, whether you have them, would like to have them, or have decided not to. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, good evening. How are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
So I'm 36 years old. My wife is 33, and we have a one-year-old and are soon to have another one, probably a little sooner than we expected, in January. I'm working full time. I have a good job. She just finished her graduate degree right before we found out we were having our second, and we're really struggling with the idea of childcare. Now, it right now doesn't make sense for her to go to work, even though she has a graduate level degree, due to the cost of childcare. And that's really hampering our ability to even consider a third. So I think just, you know, from a millennial standpoint, you know, childcare, other than having grandparents watch them, is really a deterrent for having additional children or children in general.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call, Stephanie. A lot of people, myself and my wife included at various points, have had to weigh the is it worth it to work given the cost of childcare situation. That hasn't changed in the last 20 years or so. How big a factor is this?
Oh, I think it's a quite a big factor. And the problem is that it creates a real double bind, because in the short run, it's obviously a very convenient way and often a necessary way to deal with the stress of work and family life. On the other hand, in the long run, it really hurts women's future in the workforce, and it inhibits male participation at home. I was really glad to hear that your callers, your first two callers were male, because one of the important things we find in women's decisions or willingness to have children is how important paternal leaves and paternal attitudes are. That employed women are more likely to have a second and a third child if their partner was able to share child-rearing duties. And they didn't have to completely sacrifice work in order to build their family. So that's another important consideration.
Chris, thanks for the call. Good luck in figuring all that out. Before we go back to our callers, Stephanie, how much can things like public policy, social programs, things like that, a lot of countries around the world are trying various efforts to make it easier for people to have kids. Do we know if anything actually works?
Well, there was a somewhat a re-increase in fertility in the late 90s and the first 7 or 8 years of the 21st century in several countries that did initiate better programs for childcare and maternity leave and paternity leave, which seems to be extremely important, as I said. There are limits, though. I mean, I think there are limits in terms of how much we can expect to increase fertility to older rates in a world where we want to spend this much time with our kids, when it takes so much long to reach educational and economic maturity. And perhaps we need to also start thinking about, you know, what do we really have to have an economy that depends upon constantly expanding the market? Or are there other ways that we can begin to utilize our natural and our people resources?
Let's go back to our callers. Mark is with us in Eau Claire. Mark, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to share how my wife and I go about it. And we're both 27 and 28. She's just a little older than I am. And after we bought our first house, we waited about a year, and we actually ended up fostering a son first. And we still plan on having some kids of our own. But I've just been a little more curious every time I hear the conversation, if there's more of a correlation between when millennials buy our first houses and then start having kids, or if it's, you know, related to more and more people that just don't buy a house and continue to rent for a longer time.
Mark, thanks for the call, and thank you for serving as a foster parent. By the way, Stephanie, a home buying, having a secure home, and making that decision to have kids, how big a factor is that?
Well, I don't have exact data on that, but of course it's a huge factor. I mean, you just look at, I got my first grandchild this over the COVID period. And by the way, there was an interesting bump in fertility rates of American-born women during COVID, which suggests that the opportunity to work from home and the kind of income supports that were in place may have an impact on people's decision. But certainly, if you can't afford to buy a house, if you're worried about your mortgage payments might not be able to make them, you could be foreclosed, that's a very risky situation to bring a child into the world with.
Thanks again for that call, Mark. Stephanie, another stat I wanted to touch on. In one Pew survey, they ask in different ways about people's attitudes toward kids. And one of them, they're asking for people who don't have kids. A little over half of them surveyed said it was simply because they didn't want children. We've talked about a lot of the economic factors here. You touched on it briefly earlier. How big a factor is people don't necessarily feel that social pressure that having kids is just what you do?
Well, I think that's very important that people do feel free to say, I choose not to have kids, just as which was just in the 1950s, you were really looked down upon. It was a real social stigma to admit that you didn't want to have kids. On the other hand, when we actually look at the complex of reasons why people say they don't want kids, it gets more complicated. There was a New York Times a poll that gave people a lot of choices. The biggest number was the childcare is too expensive. Then was want more time for the children I already have, can't afford children, financial instability, then want more leisure time, worried about global instability, 35% struggle with work-life family, and even almost a third were worried about the environmental crisis. So there's a lot of things going on. And I think most people are really more ambivalent about this, and they can be tipped by the economic stresses, the social stresses, and their worries about the future of American democracy and the American economy.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families, author of a bunch of books on gender, family, and history, including the forthcoming For Better and Worse, The Problematic Past and Uncertain Future of Marriage. She talked to us about why millennials are less likely to have kids than previous generations. Probably have her back to talk about that book when it comes out. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, UW System schools have announced layoffs and employee buyouts lately. What does that mean for students? We'll check in with college students from around the state. And an international program with strong roots in Wisconsin is getting women involved in more outdoor activities. We'll find out about the Becoming an Outdoors Woman project tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, find out why facial recognition systems are on the rise and what it all means for our privacy with the author of the new book, Your Face Belongs to Us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Facial recognition technology used to belong to the world of science fiction, often portrayed in futuristic societies along with flying cars and robots. But as algorithms and artificial intelligence have improved, this technology has become more and more effective. We're seeing it used in more and more places now. It has the potential to enhance security by requiring your face to gain access to important information, but it comes with big concerns over surveillance and privacy when pictures of our faces are already all over social media and the internet at large. Our next guest has been covering these issues surrounding facial recognition technology. In a new book, she tracks its development and potential for misuse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the current state of facial recognition technology, how it is, what it's being used? What do you think of the idea that somebody with a picture of your face can access lots and lots of information about you? Do you use some kind of facial recognition, say, on your smartphone? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Kashmir Hill is a technology reporter at the New York Times. Her new book is called Your Face Belongs to Us: A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. Kashmir, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
I want to start at the end of your book, Kashmir, because it's clear this is not a hypothetical technology that may be out there some way. Facial recognition is being used. Give us a sense of who's using it and how widely it's being used.
So face recognition is widely available now. Police are using it to investigate crimes, to identify criminal suspects. Stores are using this to identify known shoplifters, to kind of intercept them, kick them out. Madison Square Garden, the events venue in New York, has been using it to keep out not just security threats, but lawyers who work for firms that have sued it. And increasingly, facial recognition technology that kind of searches the internet for a face is available to normal people with subscription services on the internet and even free sites.
Now, I want to take it back to the start of the story. You get a tip. Now, there was a point, of course, where this wasn't being used. You got a tip. Bring us into the start of the story for you as a reporter.
Yeah, so it was the fall of 2019. I got a tip from a public records researcher who had been sending inquiries to police departments around the country, asking them, hey, which facial recognition companies are you using and how much are you paying for it? And at that point, you know, we knew that police used face recognition technology to try to find people in kind of criminal mugshot databases or in driver's license databases. But as far as we knew, it didn't work that well. The algorithms weren't very powerful. It wasn't really that reliable of a tool. But I get this tip that that some police departments are using a new tool called Clearview AI. And the company claimed to have scraped billions of people's faces from the public internet, including social media sites, and developed this algorithm that worked with something like 98.6% accuracy to identify people. And when I first heard about it, I thought, oh my gosh, can this be real? But the public records request that this researcher had gotten from the Atlanta Police Department included a legal memo from a very high profile lawyer named Paul Clement, who said he had used the tool with lawyers at his firm, that it worked very reliably. He said that there were already hundreds of police departments that were using it, and he had written this legal memo to basically reassure police departments who wanted to try the tool that they wouldn't be breaking state and federal privacy laws.
Tell us how, in its current state and over the last couple of years, it works. I start with a picture of somebody, maybe somebody I saw on the street, or if I'm a police officer, a security camera picture. Then what happens with that picture?
Yeah. So when I first started looking into Clearview AI, the company did not want to talk to me. They're kind of avoiding me, and there wasn't a lot of information about them. So I ended up going to police officers and finding police officers had used the tool. I talked to one of them, a detective in Gainesville, Florida, named Nick Ferrara, and he described how this worked. He said that, you know, he got a 30-day free trial to Clearview AI, and he had a stack of kind of unsolved cases on his desk. He was a financial crimes detective. So these are photos of people that are standing in an ATM or at a bank counter. And he started running these people's photos through Clearview AI, and it would lead him to other photos of them on the internet. And so he would find their Facebook profiles or their Venmo accounts. And so it was, he said, shockingly good at, you know, taking a photo of an unknown person and leading you to their name or their social media profile. And he loved the tool. He said it worked even when somebody was, you know, looking away from the camera or wearing glasses or wearing a hat. And he said, I'd be this company's spokesperson if they'd have me.
Talking to Kashmir Hill from the New York Times, author of the new book, Your Face Belongs to Us, A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. You could join in with your questions, maybe your concerns about this kind of facial recognition system at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kashmir, you recount decades-long efforts to have some sort of computerized facial recognition system, major universities, some big companies we've heard of try to get into it, Google, Facebook, things like that. And then there's this Clearview, which looks from the outside like this fly-by-night company of, at best, quirky characters. Give us a taste of what Clearview is like and why they were the ones who ended up cracking this and selling it, their services, to police departments and maybe others.
Yeah, I mean, when I was first talking to this detective and other officers who described to me this really astounding tool, I thought, wow, how is it that some, you know, random startup has built this? They must have a technological genius who works there, who is, you know, able to do something that the big technology giants and even the government hadn't been able to do. But then when I began looking into the company, they were, as you say, quite quirky. You know, they actually initially tried to deter my reporting. They put an alert on my own face so that these police officers, when they were talking to me, they were really excited at first, and then they stopped. And I discovered that when they ran my own photo to show me what the results were like, they were getting calls from the company telling them, hey, you're not supposed to be talking to a reporter, or stop talking to her, which I think they had done to try to deter my reporting, but it only made me more interested. And eventually I found out, you know, it really was this kind of ragtag crew of individuals, a really small company based in New York. Two primary founders, somebody who had been in New York politics for a long time and in media circles named Richard Schwartz, and then the technical co-founder, Juan Tan Tat, who is a pretty young guy, had always been interested in computers and technology, grew up in Australia, dropped out of college at 19 years old to move to, you know, halfway around the world to San Francisco to chase the tech boom. But when I started looking into his history, you know, what he had done before building this astounding technology was Facebook quizzes and iPhone games and an app called Trump Hair that would put the ex-president's hair on people's, you know, heads and photos. And I was just scratching my head. I mean, how did he do this? And what I would come to find out is that, you know, what Clearview did wasn't really a technological breakthrough. He was relying on open source technology and kind of facial recognition algorithms shared on GitHub. And I would discover that companies like Google and Facebook had developed something like Clearview AI internally years earlier and decided that it was too dangerous to release. And what Clearview's breakthrough was ethical arbitrage. They were just willing to do what was possible, whereas other companies had decided they didn't want to do that. They thought that the risks were too great of releasing that kind of technology.
We'll get into those risks in just a bit. I want to talk about the source of photos here, because this is one of the challenges of this technology, as you write over the decades. We need lots and lots, millions, maybe billions of pictures, including people's faces, to have this stuff work in an interesting way. They harvested them in some, I guess, ethically questionable ways. How did they get their pictures?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first places that Juan Tan Tat told me he got photos from was Venmo.com. And Venmo is the social payment site. A lot of people that first start using Venmo, when they sign up, they're pushed to be public by default. And so Venmo actually had this feature on their website that showed real-time transactions that were happening on their network. And so, you know, it would show Rob is paying Kashmir if we both had our sites, had our apps set to public. And so we actually had this scraper that would hit Venmo.com every few seconds and download the photos there and the profile URL. And he got millions of faces just from Venmo alone by doing that. And so it was really just the fact that a lot of our faces are out there on the internet. And a lot of these companies like Facebook and LinkedIn and Venmo have pushed us to kind of put our faces out there alongside our names out on the internet. And he was really taking advantage of that. In some cases, he was designing these scrapers himself. And he also told me that he would buy kind of databases of faces from other scrapers and that he sometimes didn't even know their names and he would pay for it in cryptocurrency. So it was really just kind of this race for him to get as many photos as he could. When I first wrote about Clearview AI in 2020, they had 3 billion faces. Now the company claims to have 40 billion faces in their database.
We're talking to New York Times reporter Kashmir Hill about facial recognition technology. It's real. It's being used. She tells that story in her new book, Your Face Belongs to Us, a secretive startup's quest to end privacy as we know it. Coming up, what could go wrong? You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the rules and laws should be for facial recognition technology in public? If your face is on Facebook or Venmo or whatever social site, do you think it's okay that it gets used in these facial recognition systems? Should police use these? Should everyday people have access to facial recognition technology? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Kashmira Hill, technology reporter at the New York Times. She's talking about facial recognition technology and her new book, Your Face Belongs to Us, a secretive startup's quest to end privacy as we know it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about what you're hearing here? Do you think your face is on the internet maybe too much? Do you worry about how much your kids have their faces online? Who, if anyone, should use this technology that lets you take a photo of someone and learn everything about them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kashmir, you talk to a lot of people, the ACLU and many others, concerned about how these technologies are used, if they're used at all. First of all, let's talk about when the government has it, when police departments have it. You've reported just recently about a false arrest of an 8-month pregnant woman. I think it was in Detroit, based on facial recognition technology. Talk about how the concerns about how this is being used.
Yeah, I mean, civil liberties groups have a lot of different concerns about the use of facial recognition technology. I mean, one of them is just if we are going to use it, how big is the database that we search through? And, you know, should they be using kind of smaller databases just for the city, just for the state, or a database like Clearview AIs, where, you know, you're searching for a criminal amongst 40 billion faces, you know, including lots of people who couldn't have possibly committed the crime. And then what happens, you know, if you get a doppelganger? And so that is another concern, is that, well, once you do get, you know, possible hits, do investigators fall prey to something called automation bias, which is, you know, the computer says this person may have done it, and do you then just go out and arrest that person right away? How much more investigating do you do? And that is what happened in Detroit. There was a crime committed. It was a car robbery, carjacking, and police ran a photo of somebody who was attached to the crime, and one of the top hits was Portia Woodruff, a woman who lived in Detroit. And so police showed her photo to the victim of the crime, and he said, you know, in a six-pack photo lineup, and he said, yeah, that does look like the person. He agreed with the computer essentially and said, yeah, that does look like the person who was involved in the crime. And so they went and arrested her, and she was 8 months pregnant. She spent the day being, you know, interrogated. She was charged. She had to hire a lawyer. She went to the hospital as soon as she was released because she was so stressed out by being arrested for a crime that she did not commit. You know, it can be really devastating for people who get arrested for this reason. And so this is something that activists really worry about as well, that, you know, we put too much credence in what the computer says. And then there's just a concern about, you know, how often it's used, for what kind of crimes, and the fear that maybe the government starts putting facial recognition algorithms on all of the surveillance cameras and creates this kind of state of real-time face tracking. I think that is the kind of nightmare scenario for a lot of civil liberties groups.
Yeah, and no surprise, China heavily investing in using this kind of technology. But one case that struck me was in London, in the UK. Can you talk about, you know, it's not a case of, hey, we're taking a picture of somebody suspected of committing a crime, running it through the system. They're just out in the street videoing everybody?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a range of deployment of facial recognition around the world. So in Moscow, there are real-time, facial recognition programs running on the surveillance cameras. Same in China. In the UK, they're not quite there yet, but they're essentially doing kind of trial balloons, or in this case, trial mobile vans. So they will send vans out onto the street with facial recognition cameras on the roof, and they'll park it somewhere and then search the crowds for anybody who's wanted by the courts. And they've done this several times now. And yeah, they'll just pick people up because of, in one case, it was some kind of traffic infraction. And the Metropolitan Police wouldn't tell me exactly what the traffic infraction was, but whether it was, you know, speeding or unpaid parking tickets. But yeah, I mean, they just picked that person off the street. And so civil liberties groups in the UK are really worried about that. And there's one called Big Brother Watch. And anytime they hear about the deployment of one of these vans, they kind of show up with signs and try to warn people and say, is this the world we want?
Kashmir Hill is with us talking about her new book, Your Face Belongs to Us, A Secretive Startup's Quest to End Privacy as We Know It. Kashmir, that's official use. There's debate within Clearview. Some of the owners are like, hey, let's just sell this to police departments. A key investor saying, no, everybody needs this. We need to sell this to everybody. Can you talk about the concerns if, you and I and everybody can start using this kind of facial recognition system?
Yeah, in that case, there's two buckets of concerns, right? We could imagine stores just knowing who we are as we walk in the door. And what's unique about the face is it could be this token that unlocks everything there is to know about you, right? It could link you to your online dossier so that we could be tracked in the real world the same way we're tracked online, where maybe the store knows, how much you have to spend or what your interests are or who you work for or what your political leanings are. And that's why I was so disturbed to see the way that Madison Square Garden started using facial recognition technology in the last year. They were essentially discriminating against lawyers who worked at law firms that had lawsuits against them. They said, you're not allowed in here anymore. You can't come to Knicks games. You can't come to Rangers games. You can't come to concerts until your law firm drops its suit. And so you could really imagine other business owners potentially using it in that way. The other concern is just how we might use it as individuals. As I said at the outset, there are now face search engines that are on the internet that anyone can use. And so you can imagine the different scenarios here. Maybe protesters outside of a Planned Parenthood, a woman walks out, they can take her picture and possibly know who she is. Or you're at the pharmacy and you're buying something sensitive, you're buying hemorrhoid cream, and somebody standing next to you thinks it's funny, takes your photo, figures out who you are, and kind of blasts it out onto the internet just because they're trolling you. I actually think about this every time I'm at dinner and I'm having a really sensitive conversation where I'm in earshot of strangers. What if they suddenly got interested in what I'm talking about? They just kind of take my photo and they find out who I am, and all of a sudden they understand the context of what I'm saying. There's just so many times that we are out in public where we're just protected by being anonymous, by being surrounded by people who don't know who we are. And that could potentially go away if facial recognition becomes very ubiquitous or very widely used.
In our last couple of minutes, Kashmir, there have been lawsuits. There have been some efforts at the state and federal level to have laws to define how this works. What is the current state of legality when it comes to these facial recognition systems?
So there's really nothing in the United States that applies at the federal level. There's a few states who have relevant laws. Illinois has this very unique law that says that companies need to get people's consent to use their biometrics, including their face print. So it kind of prohibits it, this kind of use outside of government use. There are a few state privacy laws that give you the ability to access your information and get it deleted from a company's database. So if you live in California, for example, you can go to Clearview AI and say, hey, I don't want to be in your database, delete me. Wisconsin does not yet have such a law, but there is a bill that's been discussed there that would give Wisconsin the ability what do you call people who live in Wisconsin?
Wisconsinites.
Wisconsinites, the ability to do that. At this point, we just don't have very strong privacy laws in this country. So there isn't a lot of protection against this.
In our last few moments, this story is a moving target. The book is out. You're still reporting on it. What do you have your eye on next?
I mean, one thing I'm really looking at is whether we can get some laws passed. I have been kind of traveling around the country and talking about this, and I found audiences are pretty outraged that they don't have control over whether their face ends up in one of these databases. And so kind of just keeping a track on of that, whether we get some kind of privacy legislation that moves, whether at the federal level or in more states.
Kashmir, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Kashmir Hill, technology reporter at the New York Times. She was with us today to talk about facial recognition technology. It is out there. It is being used. Her new book is called Your Face Belongs to Us, a secretive startup's quest to end privacy as we know it. I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, stream live, or check out and share our archives, or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.